This episode is brought to you in part by the American Homebrewers Association, who invites you to give the gift of membership this holiday season. Purchase a membership gift card with promo code GIFTIPA, that's all one word, G-I-F-T-I-P-A, and receive a free copy of Dick Cantwell's book, Brewing Eclectic IPA, Pushing the Boundaries of India Pale Ale. Visit homebrewersassociation.org today for details. That's homebrewersassociation.org. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, November 7th, 2019. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, we hear from Scott Janish of Sapwood Cellars and author of The New IPA, A Scientific Guide to Hop Aroma and Flavor. Scott leads us through hopping on the hot side to get juicy hop character for today's hazy IPAs. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. And if you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. Thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list, growing all the time, of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Financial supporters have already had a chance to see the video episode that I'm planning to release this week, featuring what I'm calling my Wyoming Vienna Kolsch. Is it really a Kolsch? I don't know, but it's brewed with Kolsch yeast, which is where the name comes from. And I brewed it with Vienna malt from Wyoming Malting Company. It's very simple beer, but one that was very crushable, as Steve said. I say was because it's all gone. What I've got on tap now is a big, dark Belgian-style ale. It's very drinkable, too, but at 7.9% ABV, it is best enjoyed more slowly. I've also got another beer working in the fermenter that's based on my 15-minute Saison that I brewed a while back. I'm putting a twist on this one by dry-hopping it with the hops left over from the hop sampler series. More than 3 ounces of pellets from various opened bags that I found in my freezer. And I only used the ones that smelled really good, so I have high hopes for that beer. I got to share my little cider that I made the other day with Steve Wilkes. I made it with unfiltered organic apple juice and A40 bubbles from our friends and sponsors, Imperial Organic Yeast. Bubbles is the latest seasonal yeast and Imperial's first gluten-free offering. They say Bubbles is a traditional cider strain that's beautiful for fruit juice-based fermentations. It's got a clean profile, and I can tell you that it did a great job with my cider. The apple character is bright and clean and just tastes like fall. I bottled half of the cider plain, and the other half I spiked with a little bit of cinnamon whiskey. Mmm, turned out pretty good. I've got another pack of bubbles, and I'm thinking about trying my hand at a fruit wine. You know Imperial Organic Yeast. They've got the highest cell counts available to homebrewers, 200 billion cells, which give you happy, healthy, and reliable fermentations. My stir plate feels neglected because I hardly need it anymore. Look for A40 Bubbles and all the great Imperial strains at your local homebrew shop. Imperial Organic Yeast. While I'm thinking about it, it's getting close to time to record our annual brewing disaster show. I haven't gotten with Steve to figure out when we're going to do that. But, you know, we always, at the end of the year, we always get together and read your brewing disaster stories and give out prizes for those who submit just a little prize packet for those who submit your stories. So send those to james@basicbrewing.com. And unless you're unusual and didn't have a disaster story this year, but I'm starting to work on a project that I hope it won't be a disaster. On Halloween, I started a fermented hot sauce. Our friend Ed Nicholson, whom you've seen on our video show, make cooked hot sauce. Ed gave me a bunch of homegrown peppers. Included in it were atomic starfish, which is a pepper that's delicious. It's an unusual shape, and the flesh is mild, but the seeds are hot. He also gave me a handful of ghost peppers and a whole lot of Carolina Reapers, which are like the hottest peppers on the planet. Well, as I say, on Halloween, I donned a pair of rubber gloves and I cut up a bunch of those, adding some of my homegrown habaneros to the mix. And I also cut up some onion, some carrot, and garlic, and I mixed up a brine that's 5% salt, and I put it all in there. And I posted a picture on Instagram. And a few days later, it started bubbling. It looks like fermentation is well underway, and I'm assuming that that's lactobacillus at work, and I'm hoping that the pH will fall to make the veggies shelf-stable. And my plan is to collect the fruit, go outside, and blend it all together in my blender. So, wish me luck on that. I know it's going to be very, very, very hot, so stay tuned. Hey, it's brewing season up here in the Northern Hemisphere and time to update your brewing gear at our friends and sponsors, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. If you're still brewing with propane, do yourself a favor and make the switch to electric brewing. High Gravity has been making electric systems for more than a decade, and they have their own line of Warthog controllers. If you watch the video podcast, you've seen it. I have one myself, and I love it. Go to highgravitybrew.com. You can not only see High Gravity's Warthog systems, you can see electric gear from other manufacturers too. Take the pain out of propane with an electric system that will let you maintain rock-solid mash temperatures, easily do step rests, and never have to worry about running out of gas. From 5 gallons up to 2 barrels, highgravitybrew.com has a system that's right for you. And if you use the code EBC75BB, you can save $75 off your electric gear purchase. That's at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com. Okay, Scott Janisch, you've heard him before on this show. He's co-founder of Sapwood Cellars in Columbia, Maryland, along with our friend, mad fermentationist Mike Tonsmeyer. Scott's written The New IPA, A Scientific Guide to Hop Aroma and Flavor, which talks about research into what makes juicy, delicious IPAs and how to keep them that way, juicy and delicious. This week, I asked Scott to talk about hopping strategies for the hot side of the brewing process. Scott Janisch, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, we had fun. The last time we talked about stability in these juicy, hazy, new IPAs. And this time we're going to talk about hopping on the hot side. Now, when I first started brewing, big American IPAs were on the rise. And at that point, it seemed like to me that, you know, there were fairly standard hopping strategies. You know, you hopped at the beginning of the boil for bitterness and then maybe halfway, you know, in between for flavor. And then, you know, at the end, a bit at the end of the boil for aroma. And then the big thing to do at that time to get the most hop flavor and aroma was to dry hop and just, you know, throw a ton of hops into the fermenter or into the serving vessel. So I take it by reading this book that times have changed.
Science has evolved a little too.
and I guess there's something to do with the character of the beers that we're talking about because, that old-fashioned, now old-fashioned strategy of hopping kind of lends itself well to the more, you know, either old-world IPAs or the West Coast IPAs. But with these new juicy, hazy IPAs, you guys are going a different way.
Yeah. I mean, there's been a strong focus on late hopping and, of course, dry hopping to try to get these beers as bold and juicy as possible. But it's not just as easy as throwing, a whole bunch of hops at a beer post-fermentation or even during active fermentation to get that big, bold flavor. I mean, one of my complaints as I sample a bunch of New England IPAs when I'm traveling or just buying something off the shelf is that a lot of them don't focus enough on hop side hopping. It's almost non-existent. And to me, that usually just lends a beer that's, for whatever reason, the vegetal material kind of taste from dry hopping is just exaggerated. And there's no hop saturated flavor that kind of that carries through into the final beer. And you kind of have this one note sort of aggressive green sort of aftertaste that just dies. And you get like a generic kind of hop taste. Like you couldn't pick out certain varieties in some of those beers just because they're just it's too vegetal. And then the flavor just dies. So as soon as you take a swallow, it's gone. So hopefully I can convince a few people to use a little bit more hops on the hot side today.
Well, let's start at the beginning. What we would call the bittering charge at the beginning of the boil. It has been common knowledge, or at least at one point, that it doesn't really matter what hops you use at the beginning of the boil because you're just looking for IBUs and the boil is going to strip all the hop character out of those hops. So it doesn't matter what you use. It's just it's the alpha acid number on the package that matters. Is that true?
No. I was brewing like that until I was, started digging through papers to, write this book. That was always my thought process was, whatever I had on hand, whatever was left over from a previous batch, or I would just get the traditional bittering hops and I would use those and throw them in at, 60 minutes to get that base sort of bitterness contribution. But it turns out some of those the hops actually matter and the flavors and the compounds that can come from those early boil additions can actually carry through into the final beer, which, depending on what you're looking for, can be a good or bad thing. But in the case of hazy IPAs, which was the focus of this book, I would tend to think some of these boil addition flavors are not what people are looking for. The term that's used the most in the research is kettle aroma. The traditional kettle aroma is like a spicy, woodsy sort of earthy, herbal kind of character. And this certain hops, mostly like noble hops that are high in hydrocarbons. So these are the more volatile compounds in hops, like myrcene. The things that are more volatile means they're driven off a lot easier compared to the monoterpene alcohols, for example, like linalool and geraniol, which are more polar and will stay in the beer a little longer. These hops that are high in hydrocarbons, particularly alpha-humulene and beta-caryophyllene, have been tested in the research to create oxidized hydrocarbons that are increased during the boil and will lead to more of this kettle aroma in the finished product. So it kind of shows that there's certain hops that if you're using early in the boil will actually contribute to more of this flavor that can kind of clash with what you would think of in a tropical hazy IPA.
So there's actual biotransformation happening during the boil?
Yeah, there's oxygenated compounds that are formed during the boil from the hops. So from these hydrocarbons in the hops, there's oxygenated compounds formed during the boil that are not being formed, for example, if you use these same hops in the whirlpool. So the heat is kind of required to create these compounds. And these are compounds that are tested in the wort after the hops are added. So it's completely hop-derived. So some of the hops that can increase the kettle aroma when boiled. So these would be hops high in alpha humulene and beta caryophyllene. As I mentioned earlier, it would be like Pacifica, Vanguard, Holler Tower, Nelson, East Kent Golding, sorry, Northern Brewer. These are a lot of times used as kind of throwaway hops that people just traditionally like, oh, I'll just throw them in to get my IBUs. And it's not going to contribute much. But in actuality, the research tends to say, yeah, it might actually be creating some of that kettle spicy flavor that, you know, again, you might want, but most of the time you don't in a hazy IPA.
So we know the bad guys or for this kind of thing. What are the hops that we would want to use if we want to go away from the kind of more traditional spicy, you know, and suppress that so that we can get those fruit flavors? You know, what are the hops that we want to add at the beginning of the boil?
Yeah, so these would be obviously the complete opposite. So they wouldn't have those compounds, and they would still be high in alpha acids because, of course, you're trying to get bitterness from these hops. So these would be like Laurel, Citra, Bravo, Galaxy, and Columbus is another one. It doesn't, for like commercial brewers, you might be like, why am I going to throw, you know, expensive Citra in the hot side here? Because it's not going to contribute to that fruity flavor in the end, but it might be helping you not get another compound that you don't want either, which is more of that woody kind of flavor. So, you know, I like to like at Sapwood, for example, we'll just take, if we know we're going to be, let's say we have some 2017 Citra that doesn't smell, you know, amazing. I'm not comfortable using it as a dry hop addition. We might just take, you know, a few pounds of that and throw it in as a bittering addition, for example. So it's a good way to use some of those older hops. And we have, I mean, it's tricky when it comes to like dry hopping on a commercial scale, because you will open a bag of like 22 pound Citra or Galaxy, and if it doesn't smell great, you almost always have to have a backup bag just in case, because it's not going to magically get better when you add it to the beer for a dry hop. So, mm-hmm. Luckily, we usually have a couple bags. Mike does a great job of ordering all of our ingredients, and so there's always a few backups. And so those are ones that we'll just kind of use for mash hopping and early boil additions.
Yeah, every now and then I get a question, you know, from a brewer. It says, I found this beer kit that I've had in my closet for, you know, a year or two. Is it going to make good beer? And, you know, my response is usually, well, you know, if you find stale ingredients to make a cake or, you know, make any kind of food product, is it going to make good food product, or, you know, are you going to go out and buy some new stuff? So it does pay attention to pay attention to the quality of your or it does pay to pay attention to the quality of your ingredients going in.
It's true. You just have to be, you know, honest with yourself and trust your instincts when you open a bag of hops, for example. Like, it pains me sometimes for like 2018 Galaxy. There's a few bags that I'd open. It was just smelled like, you know, like wet basement or something. Mm. And at $30 a pound, you really, really want to use those in the dry hop, but it's just going to, you know, not ruin the beer, but it's not going to, you know, put it over the edge. So like, for example, I think a really good bag of Galaxy smells like that fruit stripe gum. Mm. It's like, that's my, if it doesn't smell like that, then, you know, what else do I have on hand?
Now, what about the middle of the boil? You know, say if you're doing a 60-minute boil, if you're halfway through, it seems like that period of time has been kind of neglected recently. You know, people are doing like a bittering charge at the beginning and then lots of hops at the end. But in that middle ground, is that just dead space, or does it pay to put some hops in there?
I tend to think it's kind of dead space. I mean, we're not putting anything in at 30 minutes, for example. Kind of going along what we discussed last time on trying to remove some of those metal ions that can cause problems down the road for stability issues, maybe a 30-minute addition might be beneficial. But I tend to think, you know, mash hop, get a 60-minute charge, and then whirlpool hop. Mash hopping is actually interesting. We talked a little bit about that last time, but there's some research from Ballast Point that I love when it comes to IBU pickups from Whirlpool hops and just how much IBUs are lost during fermentation and throughout the whole brewing process. But they actually found it at mash hopping, whether they use like, was it a quarter of a pound per barrel or a half pound per barrel in mash hopping, which would be about 20 grams or 40 grams for a 5 gallon, is that 19 liter batch? They would have like the same IBUs from that. So there's almost like a pullback of IBUs from those mash hop additions. Almost like they were like that. The isomerized alpha acids were being degraded by heat, I think was their guess as to why that was happening. So, so that's kind of makes you feel like, you know, a lot of hazy IPAs that I mentioned earlier at the beginning, or, you know, a lot of brewers aren't using a lot of, hot side hops because they're just afraid of bitterness now. People want, you know, that juicy flavor with, you know, almost like a sweet type of flavor with, without a lot of balancing bitterness. I still think it's important, but the amount of losses to hot side alpha acids is pretty great through the process. So, you know, we can talk a little bit about that if you're interested.
Oh, sure. I'll let you take the reins at any point in the conversation.
this is still the Ballast Point research that I included in the book, and I believe this was kind of last minute before it was printed. I just happened to come across it. Part of the problem with doing a science heavy book like this is the science keeps coming out, and you can't ever publish. It's like, I gotta add that. But this one, they found not only the mash hopping, there's like a pullback from that, but they found as the gravity increases of a beer, the IBU pickup was reduced. And they found also that in Whirlpool hopping, IBU pickup peaked at about 10 minutes and then drastically reduced. So almost all of your IBUs are coming from the first 10 minutes of your whirlpool. And then depending on the temperature of your whirlpool, that can have an impact.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course, there's loss to IBUs through just, TRUB and, yeast cell absorption. And then on top of that, these heavily, heavily dry hop beers, just the vegetal material of hops is pulling out, isomerized alpha acids, during the dry hop and replacing them with another acid, but it's less bitter. So there's so much room to throw hops on the hot side to get as many compounds as you can into the fermenter for, you know, biotransformation and just overall, even mouthfeel from polyphenols. So there's, I think brewers may be a little too afraid of hot side hops, particularly in higher ABV beers where they can just withstand more more hops in general, both on the hot and cold side, where you're just losing so much of the bittering acids from everything else. So you don't be too afraid of throwing them in.
Yeah, there balance is a good thing.
right.
Now, I mean, you guys skip over the middle of the boil. Do you also skip over the last, you know, 5 or 10 minutes of the boil? I mean, again, back when I first started brewing, you know, you hopped at the beginning, you hopped at the middle, and then 5 or 10 minutes before the end of the boil, you threw in more hops. Are the hop compounds that you're after, are they so volatile that even 5 or 10 minutes in a full boil would make those hops kind of a waste?
I wouldn't say that it'd be a waste. A lot of the compounds I don't think you necessarily want, especially in hazy IPAs, these hydrocarbons, they're so volatile that if you're throwing them in at 5 minutes and you're pretty much losing most of those. And these would, again, be like the woodier kind of earthy flavors. But the more polar oxygenated compounds in hops, they probably would be driven off a little bit with a 5 minute addition, but they're also able to stick around a little more. But there is research to show that if you're lowering the temperature of your whirlpool, for example, and throwing hops in at like 185 degrees, which help me out there if you know the Celsius on that.
185 is about what? 85 degrees
Celsius. 85. Thank you.
Yeah.
That would be you would get more more retention of some of the compounds that we the research considers to be indicators of hoppiness, like linalool. So if you're going to retain more of those at a slightly lower whirlpool temperature, I would suspect that throwing them in at 5 minutes, you'd probably be losing quite a bit, but not all of it, all of those oxygenated hop compounds.
Yeah, now here's where we start to get into a difference between, you know, the homebrew scale and the commercial scale, because you guys have a lot more wort to chill down, and you may be going through a heat exchanger where and cooling the wort as it leaves the kettle or leaves the other, you know, secondary vessel. Whereas as homebrewers, and we're using an immersion chiller, we're chilling the whole wort at the same time. So the timing of when we put these hops in and, you know, how long that they sit at these different temperatures, you know, that's one of the bigger differences, I think, between home brewing and commercial brewing, right?
Yeah, it's always been a little interesting to me that home brewers will basically mimic this with like long whirlpool times, right? So they'll do like a 40-minute whirlpool rest, when commercial brewers are really only doing it because it's just how long it takes, you know, to cool 300 gallons of wort. I'm not saying that's what, you know, everyone should do as quick as they can when it comes to cooling down your wort for whirlpool additions. But some of the research in the book, this unfortunately was just hydrocarbons that were tested, but they found spikes in these compounds almost immediately when adding them to the wort. So it makes sense to me in some ways that if the heat is extracting these compounds so quickly, it kind of makes sense to try to lock them in as quickly as possible too. Mm-hmm. So there could be some research or some experiments done with, you know, quick cooling versus long hop stands. I mean, if you think about, you know, dry hopping, you can get pretty quick extraction in a matter of days, and at 70 degrees, you know, if you're at 190 degrees, those compounds are probably getting into the wort pretty quickly.
Now, one thing that we can do, and it looks like that y'all are experimenting with this as well, is after the boil, lowering the temperature of the wort to a certain temperature, a target temperature, and then adding the hops. And I've experimented that, you know, since I've got this, you know, fancy electric system from High Gravity in Tulsa, sponsors of the show. I can lower the temperature of the wort with my immersion chiller, and then stop, and using the mash mode of that, you know, system, I can maintain a certain temperature for, you know, as long as I want. So let's talk about the role of temperature versus time, and how those affect each other, and the effect on the beer. So what are the best, if you're going to do something like that, or if you guys, you know, lower the temperature of your wort, you know, before doing whirlpool hopping, what role do those temperatures play?
Two main roles, I think. And we'll do this. Actually, we've started moving to cooling our wort to about 170 to 180 on almost all of our hoppy beers now. This is something we were playing with beforehand, and then we went down to the West Coast and did a collaboration with Modern Times and became even more confident that it was a better way to get more hop compounds into your beer, because the lower the temperature, the more hops you can throw in the whirlpool, and without getting as much bitterness. And there's also there's one study that I always point to, and I kind of hope there's more on this, because it's pretty interesting. Is they whirlpooled the same beer, same hops at different temperatures. So it was let's see, I actually have the Celsius in front of me for this one. It was 203 degrees Fahrenheit, 95 C, and then 185 degrees Fahrenheit, 85°C, and 167 degrees Fahrenheit, 75°C. And what they found was that the warmer whirlpool temperatures, there was higher marks for citrus and ester descriptors. At the lower 85°C temperature, the beers scored higher for floral and herbal descriptors, but also had more overall oil compound retention. And even lower than that, at 167, 75°C, they scored lowest in almost every category. So the overall aroma and flavor, and then they were higher in some of those, what you would typically think of as hydrocarbon flavors, the woody kind of compounds. So we want to just get as much as we can into the fermenter in terms of hop compounds. We want bitterness. We're not afraid of bitterness. We just want it to be balanced. We don't want it over the top. And of course, like I was saying earlier, there's so much room for hot side IBUs to be stripped during the process. So we're not completely afraid of that, but lowering that temperature just helps a little more with that. And we're using, from talking to other brewers locally and around the country at various like beer festivals and stuff, we're using probably a little higher whirlpool hopping rate than a lot of others. Some breweries are just limited because of their setup and, you know, clogging issues and things like that. But we're about 22 pounds of hops in a 10 barrel batch, so a little over 2 pounds per barrel. So for home brewers, that would be, about 180 grams, so 6 ounces per 5 gallon, 19 liter batch. Mm. But there's always more variables, right? So home brewers, you know, are brewing on probably like a 10 gallon pot, big surface area. They're getting a lot more evaporation than a professional setup. So they might be losing a little bit more, or you could make a case that homebrewers might be losing a little more of the compounds from evaporation than a professional setup. So you might even want to increase those whirlpool additions even more on the homebrew scale.
And you said, I think this is the part where you said if professional brewers are concerned about clogging their heat exchanger, they could use a hop back instead of just, you know, having them kind of loose in the kettle.
Yeah, you could use a hop back. What we started doing is, at first we would just leave back some, like a barrel of water from the recipe. So basically overbrewing a little bit. And then we would just add cold filtered water directly to the kettle after the boil. And that would drop the temperature a little bit. But that wasn't really dropping it enough for us. So now we run it through our heat exchanger and back into the kettle before adding our dry hops. So that usually will drop it. We'll get it down to about 170 degrees, turn off our cold water going to our heat exchanger and let it keep recirculating in and out of that heat exchanger until the kettle stops changing temperatures, you know, as basically just mixing in that cold water, getting a good reading, or colder wort getting a good temperature, steady temperature reading. And then we have to move our hoses around because we have a manual setup. And then we'll add our hops and whirlpool. We just do it that way so we don't clog our heat exchanger.
So what about time? Because you said even at, I think it, as low as like 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32°C, you're still isomerizing alpha acids, albeit at a, you know, really low level. But, you know, more time equals, again, more bitterness.
Yeah, more. It takes... I think it was like 207 minutes. I can't remember if that's the exact temp or amount of time that it would take to get full bitterness out of a much cooler whirlpool that you mentioned. But again, that the Ball's Point research that I talked about a little earlier, where they're getting peak IBUs at about 10 minutes, and then it just drastically reduced in terms of more IBU contributions from longer whirlpool times. To me, it just suggests that it would take a long time. I mean, no one's going to sit that long to really pick up. And with the amount of IBUs you're losing through dry hopping and yeast and everything, I think that a few more IBUs from whirlpool is probably insignificant.
And there's a couple of issues, a couple of problems that that can come about if we're not careful in our process. You say that we should be concerned about DMS or dimethyl sulfide, right?
Yeah, the there's some research that shows that the longer if you don't get the DMS precursor out, you know, during the boil, that can continue to kind of evolve during a long whirlpool, and you'll get more DMS, more of that kind of corn sort of flavor. And actually, this is something I've tasted in some a handful of commercial IBUs, and I suspect this is probably the case. Huge whirlpool additions, and maybe you know, not as much evaporation during the boil. On the professional setup, it can be, you know, less than 5%. So I mean, you can if you're going to do long whirlpools, you can maybe do a 90-minute boil. We'll typically open up our manway to our kettle for the last 10-15 minutes of a boil, just to kind of help hopefully drive off a little more. This isn't something I really ever had problems with as a home brewer. Maybe that's just because of the higher evaporation rate that I talked about earlier. But mm-hmm. And really it's not a concern for a lot of people, but if you are getting that corn kind of flavor in a hazy IPA, you know, just make sure you're taking the normal brewing steps to get rid of DMS that, you know, that's fairly well known.
So it's just sitting at that whirlpool temperature for an extended period of time where you have the more of a risk of getting the DMS character coming in?
Yep, exactly. And it's interesting that you would think if you throw a whole bunch of dry hops at a beer, you can cover up some of those flavors like that. But when there was research in the book that the more dry hops in the beer actually lowered the threshold for DMS. So it's actually
so it's easier to taste it.
It's easier to taste it, yeah. And I guess the other thing that was interesting when it comes to whirlpool hopping is hot side aeration or hot side oxidation. I know that's a debate for quite a while. Brewers like to talk about if hot side aeration is good or bad or doesn't matter. But there is some research that shows that any hot side oxidation within the presence of large amount of hops, so think about big whirlpool additions, can actually lead to a green onion file. It's 2M3MB during fermentation. So this, I don't know if you've had any hazy IPAs that are sort of green oniony. Sometimes that's just the result of the hops that were used. But hot side aeration during whirlpool can be a cause of that. So you know, for home brewers, that's just, you know, when you drop your immersion chiller in with your whirlpool hops and you're like, you know, splashing that immersion chiller around trying to cool it down, you might be better off just playing it safe and just letting the cold water go through until it the temperature drops, you know, quite a bit. The hotter the wort and the more hops, the greater chance of that thiol developing in the presence of oxygen.
And unless you're Booker T and the MGs, green onion in your beer may not. Are you old enough to get that reference?
Gosh, no, but I laugh for you.
We got old guys in the audience. They know. but again, if you're not swirling your immersion chiller around, you know, you probably want to do it gently. But if you're not, you know, kind of being aggressive and swirling that immersion chiller around, again, it's taking longer to chill down your wort. So you're kind of extending your whirlpool time or your hop stand time at that point as well. So that's got to be factored in too.
Yeah, but I don't think it'll matter too much. I mean, I would imagine, I'm trying to remember when I was using my chiller, I think I could get it down to 150 degrees or something fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. And then if you're stirring, but you're being careful not to, you know, do it too aggressively, you're probably fine. And if you're not having if you don't have this green onion thing in your previous beers, then it's your process is probably fine, and you shouldn't really need to worry. There's enough things to worry about when it comes to brewing, right?
Yeah, every week we add more.
Yeah, exactly.
Do this, don't do that.
Yeah. No, it this was interesting because the paper that I saw this from, it even I think it mentioned that, just negative pressure coming in through pumps and the gaskets, if your clamps aren't tightened down all the way, that air getting in could even be sort of a could be a cause of some of this style. So we'll run our we'll typically hook up our Whirlpool rig and run some wort through it before we're done with the boil, like 10, 15 minutes left. Kind of pasteurizes the lines as well as gets any oxygen out of that out of the whole system before we start adding those Whirlpool hops.
Well, excellent. Are there any other important high points? There's lots of information in the book, and we're just hitting the high points. But is there anything else, any major point that we missed in this conversation about hot side hopping?
We did actually covered quite a bit. No, I just I, again, I just I think brewers shouldn't be too afraid to try to get as many compounds into the fermenter as they can, and not be too afraid of picking up too much in terms of IBUs. There's more research later in the book when it comes to thiols, for example, that more of these monoterpene, these fruity, more polar hop compounds that we can get into the beer on the hot side can be biotransformed during fermentation. And if you're using hops, for example, high in 4-MMP, which would be like Citra, Simcoe, Galaxy, Nelson, those can actually, through synergy, can lower the taste threshold of those hot side monoterpene alcohols that we're getting into the beer. So it's just you're trying to get as, in my opinion, as many compounds as you can into the fermenter and kind of a diverse set of them, just to have more complexity in the flavor.
And I guess one thing that we didn't address was adding hops at different stages in the whirlpool at different temperatures, as the wort is cooling down to kind of layer the complexity of the hop character.
Yeah, I think we talked. I think we might have talked about it a little bit the three different Whirlpool temperatures, the different flavors that you can get. If I were home brewing right now, I would probably chill my wort down to, or I would probably add. I almost like I always like to recommend dry hopping in stages. I kind of like the idea of whirlpooling in stages. So if there's research to suggest that you're getting a more diverse set of hop compounds in when you're adding the hops at different times, then to me that's appealing. So I would, add my first charge of hops at knockout, so at 211 degrees or whatever, as soon as you cut the heat, just let the immersion chiller do its thing without stirring or splashing, and then add another charge when it gets to like 185, and then finish cooling. Just to try to build a little more diversity. Whether or not you can, taste that in the final beer, I guess is up for debate. But I'm always of the opinion if the research kind of lends you or gives you a reason to do something and you get good results from it, keep doing it.
Yeah, keep good notes on the brewing process and keep good tasting notes afterwards, and that way you can kind of go back and check it.
Yeah, and especially when it comes to hot side hopping, I think tasting notes right before you dry hop is important. What hops at what times from hot side hopping are giving you the best results, pre-dry hop? Because once you dry hop, that can kind of just it'll confuse kind of what's happening, because there's so many other aromatic things that are kind of playing with your mind at that point. For example, like one of the hops that we use, we found at Sapwood is Idaho 7. For whatever reason, it's just one of those hops that can just it stays through the process better than others. And we even had it dominate some dry hopping at one point when we used a lot of Idaho 7 and and dry hopped with Sabro. The Idaho 7 was coming through and almost competing with and dominating the dry hop edition, which is pretty rare when it comes to hot side hopping. But there's research that shows that, you know, some hops are just more efficient at extracting their compounds. I think Columbus, for example, was found almost double the rate at extracting linalool into beer than other hops. It's just, I can't really explain it, but that was just the results. So that just means each hop has you test it before using it, you see that it has a certain amount of a compound. And then after adding it to the whirlpool, it happened to release more of that compound than others. So there's, like we said earlier, there's so many factors. And so just using the science as a guide, as a way to inspire new recipe choices and new process choices, and then taking good notes to see if it pays off.
Yeah, that's part of what makes brewing fun, is from these four main ingredients, you know, you can between process and, type of ingredient and time applied and temperature and all these things, beer is just an amazing category of food. If people don't open themselves up to the variety of beers that are out there, you know, they're missing out so much.
I know it is crazy. The different, just yeast choice alone, the drastic different flavors you can get in beer is amazing.
What's on tap at Sapwood Cellars?
What's at tap? You know, actually it's we just hit our 1 year anniversary not too long ago. And we're hopefully this week going to hire our first full-time brewer to help us out on the back end of things. And so we're feeling more like a professional establishment. and exciting to us too is all of our we're finally releasing a lot of our barrel-aged sour beers. And this was obviously with Mike Tomsmeyer being involved. That was a big focus of our brewery, but it just took, a year to really get these beers ready. So we're brewing beer before we were open, getting them in, mostly wine barrels and letting them sit for about 10 months or so before we really, could do anything with them. And we're finally now getting to the point where we can release about one or two of those a month. So that's pretty exciting for us.
Wow. Congratulations. Time flies.
It does. It really does.
Well, I appreciate it. I hope we'll get another chance to chat again.
Yeah, no, this is great timing. I think the audiobook version of this will be released by the time this podcast is released. So that should be another avenue to put people to sleep, I guess.
You can listen while you brew.
That's right. There you go. And then question everything you're doing.
All right. Thanks, Scott.
Yep, I appreciate it.
Thanks again to Scott. Once again, the book is The New IPA, A Scientific Guide to Hop Aroma and Flavor. And if you're brewing hazy, juicy beers, it's well worth the read. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy or want to contribute your brewing disaster for this year's Brewing Disaster Show, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. I have seasonal allergies. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.